This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Let's begin with this question.
Duncan, on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you think you are?
A 6.
I think you're a 3.
Wow, let that serve as an example of how careful you should be when speaking to a writer, because whatever you may say may right. end up in their work. In this case, that was Steve Carell talking to a young actor named Liam James. But a similar exchange took place between a young Jim Rash and his stepfather that festered inside for a long time and ended up in Jim's latest film, The Way, Way Back, which he co-wrote and co-directed and which stars Steve Carell and Liam James, among others. Jim Rash is a native Charlottean who went to Charlotte Latin, but who threw all of this away and headed west to Hollywood, only to realize success in a very difficult business, in network television and in film. He appears on NBC's Community as the curious Dean Pelton. He also accepted an Oscar for co-writing The Descendants, which starred George Clooney, and just this week appeared on Jay Leno's Tonight Show. Not bad for a Charlotte boy. Now, I've been asked more times than I can tell you, Jim, by people here who know you, when are you going to have Jim Rash on? And on each successive occasion, they have become more frustrated with me and begin to regard me with deep suspicion, bordering on contempt.
Wow. Finally, we can just quell all of that
today. At last you're here. What took you so long to get here? Did we not ask? What was the problem?
I don't know what I usually respond more to gift baskets.
I see.
And I'm just still waiting.
Well, now that you're an Oscar winner, you want stuff. That's the result.
Yeah. That is the weirdest experience, because that doing the Oscar stuff, they have all these, they do give you stuff, and then you just realize this stuff, I really don't need this stuff. And it is just stuff that people want you to hold and take a picture of, and I don't understand the allure of that.
Isn't the real term swag?
Yes. I should be a little bit more Hollywood and say these swag, like swag, little gift suites. And it is everything you probably don't need in your life.
Well, I'm glad you finally made it to our program. I know it's kind of anticlimactic after the Tonight Show, but, we'll make the best of it. So what was your answer to the question that we just heard Steve Carell pose to young Liam James, young Duncan there? When your stepfather said on a scale of 1 to 10, what are you? What did you say?
No, it was like in the movie. That whole first scene is almost verbatim. I said 6. I thought at the time, being a 14-year-old, I thought that seemed very humble of me, very safe. I was just hovering just a point above average and not too cocky of me. And then he answered 3, and then subsequently had the conversation, for the most part, that Steve has, character has with Liam James' character, as far as getting out there. And we had gone to the same place at Lake Charlevoix, which is up in Michigan, every year. And this, I think, was our second year going. And he just felt like I could sort of take more advantage of all the things that the lake had to offer. And I think he was just speaking, in his mind. He had this great wisdom for this extra, introverted, slightly kid. And unfortunately, at 14, you don't hear it that way. Yeah. You just hear the number 3.
So he wasn't being mean.
No, I think, and obviously in the movie that we're using that for dramatic reasons, we're pumping up that sort of aspect of his character. And I should say that, my stepfather had many more layers and to that than just that. But I think in his mind, he thought this was really great advice. And it, regardless of tact, the message, even in the movie, is something that Duncan, Liam James' character, hears and subsequently, subconsciously, goes on this journey because of that conversation. So I think people are in your lives for reasons, and whether they're saying something that's harsh or wonderful to you, they're saying it for a reason, and you're meant to grow from it. So,
did it have some kind of, I guess it's hard to pinpoint this, but did it have some kind of residual effect on you? Did it spur you, do you think, in some small way to where you are today?
Well, maybe only in the sense as a comedian and a lover of cathartic moments in my life that I love to use, as you sort of give in the intro. My iPhone is at this moment filled with things that I type in there that my family says and for use for later, or moments that happen to me that I'm just like have to use. So I don't mind mining pain. Mm-hmm. And not that I had this extremely painful youth. I didn't. But I certainly had moments that I find very funny. And I think that's makes me who I am, you know.
And so it really is true that you have to be careful what you say to somebody who's a writer, although they didn't know you were a writer at the time, because
no.
Everything is taken note of. It becomes fodder.
It is. It is, because I think that's the best, honest place I can write from. It's the truth, you know, and not that that you know, obviously The Descendants was not a personal story that we fell in love with this book because we connected with a lot of the themes. So mm-hmm. I think for my writing partner, Nat Faxon, and I, it was we just react to stories that we can get in, that we can understand the person. So I like to think that we understand ourselves better than anyone. Not that we're that self-aware, but I love doing that stuff.
We're talking to Jim Rash, who is the co-director and co-writer of The Way, Way Back, which is in town for a very brief amount of time, which we'll talk about a little bit later on in this conversation with Steve Carell and Toni Collette and Allison Janney and others. And, of course, you know him as Dean Pelton on NBC's Community. Let's talk about what you've done and how you got to where you are, because you grew up here. You went to Charlotte Latin. And in addition, this week to doing this show, you did The Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
Yep.
I don't know many people from Charlotte who've done these things. So how did you do it? What was the path? When did you know you wanted to take that direction with your life?
I definitely did theater when I was at Charlotte Latin and had so that bug was probably planted there as far as doing plays. I ended up after graduating from Charlotte Latin, I had applied and wanted to go to Chapel Hill, but they declined me the first go around. Mm. But they suggested that I look into some postgraduate programs. While I loved theater and I loved certain things, maybe I wasn't the best student. And so I ended up going to a school called the Lawrenceville School, which is up in New Jersey, for a postgraduate year, which was very odd because postgraduates are usually athletes who are preparing to train for college. And I somehow made it in as this sort of just theater guy, I guess. But that took some, some probably finessing and chatting with them and trying to sell them on me. And luckily they did. And it was a great experience. It was 1 year, obviously. And then subsequently reapplied to Chapel Hill and got in and then went there for my undergrad. So and then when I was at Chapel Hill, I really got into student television there in addition to doing a little bit of theater stuff, but not a lot. But I did write and try to shoot and, questionable mm-hmm. sometimes material. It's, wasn't probably something you'd want to look at and go like, oh, man, I was just a savant from so early. But it was a blast. And so when I graduated, I knew that I loved the whole thing. I knew I loved acting. I knew I enjoyed writing. I knew I enjoyed possibly, being behind the camera. And so I just made that decision to get a used car and drive a cliche little drive across the country with mm-hmm. my car loaded up and my Macintosh Plus, which is like the computer that will age me. But it was like, the little R2-D2 yeah. shaped, I guess. But anyway, that was sort of the path.
And so many people take that path. And there are a lot of people who take that path who have immense amounts of talent, and you never hear of them again. Or they'll have their big break in a Metamucil commercial, and that's it. They're done.
That's where it begins.
Yeah. Yeah. But you have had success in so many different arenas out there. It's amazing, actually, because I looked through your resume today, and it's really, really long and dense. You've done a lot of stuff.
Well, I definitely, I definitely have done a lot of like guest star and stuff on TV over the years. It didn't obviously start right away, but I certainly I look back at my beginning of LA experience, and I don't think I had the worst trajectory of some people, you know, in the sense that it was maybe a 2 or 3 years in that, you know, a commercial I think was the very first thing I shot, and then I got a line on Sybil was I think my first line.
You towed her car away, didn't you?
I towed her car away, and in fact, I said that Betty White had towed her car, so you know, I was already sort of foreshadowing this new coming of Betty White, you know, many years before, and. You know, but the key for me, you know, really was when I got to L.A., I heard of the Groundlings Theater, which was a sketch comedy improv theater out here in Los Angeles. And that really, for me, became a way to shrink L.A. into a manageable community for myself. And I fell in love with improv and I fell in love with the theater. And that was my home for, you know, I was started in classes pretty much right when I came out in 95, and I just gave up my spot in the main company this year. So I was in there from that whole time as a groundling for 13 years of that time.
You know, people who do improv and do it well, particularly comedy improv, it looks so effortless, it looks so easy, and it's so funny that people think, well, I can do that. And it's not. It's really kind of scary, I mean, because you really have to be open to anything at any time and be able to switch gears on in an instant.
Yeah, you know, people always, for me, stand-up comedy terrifies me. Like the idea, I envy those who go up there and write these wonderful sets and tackle it because it's a whole other aspect of that and an art. But improv to me was this wonderful thing that I love just at the core. Is about being present, about giving and taking, about listening. It's like everything that we should do in our day-to-day lives. And I think if people get obsessed with, oh, well, I'm not funny. I won't be able to improvise and be funny. As a teacher, because I teach there as well and have directed, I'm not teaching you how to be funny. I'm here to just embrace the idea of improv. I don't care if this scene is funny. I just want you to be connected and listening and responding to what was just said and not negating what was said and going with the flow. And it's wonderful ways. That's why so many professionals, we teach anything from lawyers to business men and women and who are looking to improve their communication skills. It's really a talent that is services lots of different, you know, industries in a way, not just creative and Hollywood. It really services a lot of people. So I just fell in love with that idea.
And you are able to overlay it with comedy. Where did the comedy come from? Where did the comic sensibility and the timing that you have come from?
I don't know. You know, I can only speak to, there's a sort of science that sometimes gets created with timing when you work in, you know, television and you, because every, you know, a multi-camera, like a traditional sitcom in front of a live studio audience has sort of a rhythm to it. Mm-hmm. You know, a single camera comedy, which is much more prevalent, I would guess, these days, you know, from 30 Rock to The Office to Community, you know, self-plug.
Yes, which doesn't have an audience.
Which doesn't have an audience. Right. And single camera is just the idea that, yeah, it's shot more like a movie. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a rhythm and a change to that. But I really look back at, you know, and I think that any of the comedians that I appreciate and really think about their stories, it comes from these life experiences. I think that inherently comedy comes from a place of protecting yourself and guarding yourself, you know, about the things that happen in your life and your ability to look back and hopefully laugh again, but also have some kind of weird context for it. And sometimes that is getting ahead of the joke. In other words, yeah, it's
Let me stop because we have to stop, and we'll come back with more in a moment with Jim Rash.
Support comes from WFAE members and WBTV News 3. Mornings and evenings, the WBTV First Alert Traffic Team provides traffic updates and alternate routes. Also, on mobile app and at WBTV.com.
And support comes from Hendrick Acura, introducing the 2014 Acura MDX SUV, 6-speed automatic transmission and 28 miles per gallon, featuring heated leather seats and a sunroof. HendrickAcura.com. Coming up Monday on Charlotte Talks, we'll talk about the UNC Charlotte team who created Urban Eden for the prestigious 2013 Solar Decathlon. We'll talk about how their efforts will influence energy efficiency in the future. That's when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Thanks to your help, the WFAE Fall Fund Drive was a success. We thank you for listening and also for your support of listener-funded radio here in Charlotte on WFAE. We also want to thank Nona's Sweets Bakery Cafe at the Shops at Worthington for their support during the Fall Fund Drive.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Congress strikes a deal to reopen the government and stave off a Treasury default. Questions persist over the Obamacare rollout glitches, and Newark Mayor Cory Booker wins a special election to the Senate.
The Diane Rehm Show and the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Jim Rash. You know him as Dean Pelton on NBC's Community. He's also the Oscar award-winning screenwriter, along with several other people, of The Descendants, and he co-wrote and co-directed the new film, The Way, Way Back, with Steve Carell, Toni Collette, and Allison Janney. We were talking about comedy and where you got your sense of comedy, and I had to interrupt you in the middle of it. So timing being everything, I'll let you finish now.
Yeah. I mean, I think, if I can remember exactly what brilliant thing I was saying. I think the nugget I was just getting at was that I think for me, it's been the ability to sort of get ahead of people. You know, in other words, I think it's great to be able to, before you say something about me, believe me, I already have a self-aware understanding of myself. So, haha on me and you. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I think that's part of where, for me, I would say my comedy comes from.
Now, The Way, Way Back, I saw it last weekend. I really liked the film a lot. It's a coming-of-age film that doesn't really involve sex. It isn't full of petulant behavior, although there is some. It doesn't tug at your heartstrings as much as it nudges them. And it is not a comedy necessarily, but there are funny moments in it. The human condition is funny, and that's kind of what how this is funny. Aside from the question that we opened with, where do you rank on a scale of 1 to 10, where did the rest of the story idea come from?
Yeah, I mean, Nat, my writing partner and I, you know, like I said, we always try to pull little elements from both of ourselves and put them in there. But I think the Way, Way Back started with that opening scene, which we've discussed, and it also started with both Nat and I are both from the East Coast. Obviously, you know where I'm from, and Nat is from the Manchester by the Sea, which is, I guess, the North Shore area of Boston. Mm-hmm. And we both had, and so he spent every summer in Nantucket, and I spent most of my summers either going to Michigan or, you know, the shoreline of North Carolina, South Carolina, but it was the idea that you had that world of destination vacations where you always went to the same place and you saw the same people and you might not see them through the year. So there was always this little moment where they had this whole year of life happen. But the place you go, hopefully, for the most part, hasn't changed that much. And so it really was an interesting world for us, which is where we're living, you know, as far as a destination they always sort of land in. And Allison Janney's character, who plays Betty, sort of represents that person who sort of catches us all up on the year has passed, and here's where we're at. And then also we spent some time at water parks when we were growing up, and that was such an independent, weird world where in a different world our parents felt comfortable enough to drop us off there with maybe $20 in our pocket and pick us up at the end of the day. And you realize that probably the people that were in charge of your safety that were, you know, at the top of those slides might be 2 years your senior, because it was such like high school, you know, place where they were probably their first job. You know, they probably were trained and certified lifeguards. But that, you know, other than that, their life experience wasn't much more than yours. And we just liked that idea that this became the Oz for this kid in the movie. So those components, plus maybe some inspiration from individual characters, was pretty the nugget we started with.
So let's hear a little clip from The Way, Way Back at that water park in which Duncan, played once again by Liam James, starts to work with a guy named Owen, who I loved, played by Sam Rockwell. They're at this water park where your character, Lewis, also works at the Davy Jones Lockers and Rentals booth, and where you're not really very happy with your job.
Lewis! Hook up my man Duncan here with one of our finest rentals, would you?
Some kid threw up in your crazy tubes.
Sexy. Let's not try to impress them all at once, huh?
That will not be a challenge.
Lewis is kind of over this place.
I told you I'm not long for here.
No, I remember that conversation in 2003, 5/11, April. Yeah, sure, right?
I can't eat that now because your dirty mouth's been on it.
Germaphobe.
I just told you there's some things I want to do.
Prove it. Without thinking. Rattle off three. Go!
I've seen New Mexico, invent something, become a storm chaser.
You had me until number three. I think you gotta go to school for that.
Look, there's a storm. Where? Over there. Cool. Let's go get it. Got it.
He actually is. He's been studying meteorology since preschool. Don't let the Dahmer glasses fool you. Okay.
These don't have any mesh, so you're basically going commando. Watch Sid and your junk will fall out. Found that out the hard way at a birthday party.
And like that, you're impressed and grossed out.
What an interesting exchange.
Yes.
I have to ask, how much of that was written and how much of that is just ad-lib by the three of you?
Oh, most of it was written. You know, this was because of our tight schedule. You know, we shot this movie in 24 days and ended up actually dipping into our pockets to buy a 25th day just so we could make up for some rain days. And so when you're shooting on such a tight schedule, you can't really totally shoot a movie with these long takes of improv and exploring.
Right.
That said, there are wonderful things that all of our actors added and then we added in the moment. So there's certainly nuggets within there. I know that I think out of that particular scene, Dahmer glasses came off of Sam's mind because that was the glasses I was wearing are very Dahmer-esque. And if I can play it back in my head, but you know, in other words, there were plenty of, you know, Alice and Janie added some wonderful little things. So we were always appreciative and open to our actors to suggest or even just play with it in a third take. But for the most part, everything, you know, was on the page.
And because you have such a tight schedule, as you mentioned, you can't waste a lot of time shooting film that's never going to be in the movie. You have to kind of get it down on the film and move on.
Yeah.
How much time do you spend on rehearsal? Because all of these scenes are like this. They're overlapping dialogue, and it just seems so effortless and natural.
We lucked out, and that goes as a tribute to the wonderful cast we collected of very theater-trained and experienced actors, because we had zero rehearsal. We showed up to start shooting this movie. Everyone was coming from different projects, and save for Sam and Liam having one day that we were able to rehearse with them before we started shooting just to go through all the scenes, we didn't have it. And in other words, we started in the water park. So for those of you, it's like there are two big worlds in the movie. There's the water park world and then this home life. And we shot the water park stuff first. And so Allison Janney, Tony Collette, and Steve Carell basically showed up halfway through the shoot to begin the house stuff. And that was literally the first table read we had of the whole script from beginning to end. We did it in the middle of our shoot. So Sam had shot most of everything. So he was just sort of performing at the table read pretty much what we had already put into the can. And it really was probably the weirdly the most emotional moment, I think, of our 5 weeks shooting, because Nat and I had never had this moment to sort of just celebrate this long journey we had taken and hear it for the first time. We were hearing it, you know, halfway through and sort of like, well, we've already committed to that half of the movie, so that's shot. And it was an amazing sort of table read. We just read it inside one of the beach houses we were renting at tables. And
it's kind of fascinating to me. I've had a lot of people on who do movies and plays and things like that and directors. And I've never had a chance to ask this question. When you can shoot a movie with such virtuosity, because these performances really are wonderful in this movie, and do it without rehearsal. You've done theater as well. Why do we do all this theater in rehearsal in theater? Just memorize the lines and go do it.
Because the truth is, it is. You know, you think about. I think John Bailey, who was our DP, director of photography, did so many movies. I mean, like, you know, you can just go on his IMDb page and just read movie after movie, and one of those is Big Chill. And I believe him telling us of them having at least 2 weeks in that house of, as I recall, and, you know, there is an advantage, obviously, to being able to have these moments to find and finesse and find special moments that you might miss. It is to the, that's why I say to the credit, you know, and I think in theater as well, it's like you really want to start to connect with each other and find those moments. So I, in a perfect world, I would love to have some rehearsal. I think it's key. But in some wonderful like alignment of good fortune, our actors just came ready to go, and we just, you know, they just made it look effortless.
And they did. You wrote this script, I understand, 8 years ago, you and your writing partner, Nat. What took it so long? Because, you know, this is a stupid question, because I know a lot of films get green-lighted and then they waste away on a table someplace. But what took it so long to finally get it to the screen?
Just everything that I think is pretty normal for any kind of movie, but particularly I would say small independent movies. We wrote it 8 years ago, and it was going to be on this fast track. It was Sean Levy, who is a director and had directed many, many things, had sort of latched on to it. We were actually set up at Fox Searchlight, weirdly, that our life would lead us back to Fox Searchlight. But Sean Levy was going to direct it. It was going to be sort of a movie that he could fit in quickly in his schedule before he had to start Night at the Museum 2. Well, you know, it's perfect when you say, oh, we can get it done. But then the logistics of finding the actors, getting all the logistics, you know, the locations and everything, just everything wasn't aligning in time, and it was too late, and he had to go start shooting Night at the Museum 2. So that fell apart. Searchlight even gave us let the movie free for us to take it somewhere else that might be able to make it. We ended up at Mandate. We had another run at it with a couple of other directors. Economy took a big turn, you know, and it was hard to make small movies at all. So we got to a place where, and to make it economical, the studio said, you can make it with this actor and this actor. And those actors, while wonderful, didn't feel right for us. And Nat and I had to say, all right, you either have to wait 3 more years and wait for the screenplay, which they call come out a turnaround, which is when you have money against it. And and basically it's the idea of like, it's yours again in 3 years is the simplicity of it. It is no longer a property except to yourself. So you can wait 3 years and wait to have the script by yourself, or make it right now with these people. And that was the moment where you just had to decide, I'd rather take the long journey and do it the way we imagine than take the instant gratification.
And when,
so we did.
And when you finally got a chance to do it, it ended up being you and your writing partner, Nat Faxon, who ended up co-directing the movie. How does one become a film director, a first-time film director? Because it's not only it's a big responsibility, it's in a gargantuan project, but it's also a lot of money. I know you made this for less than $10 million, but I got to tell you, that's a lot of money. Oh, really?
No, we made it for less than $5 million.
Well, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. No, it's still a lot of money, but not in you realize how you envy everyone who's made a movie for $500,000 or $1,000 or $1 million, whatever. You have to figure out how to stretch it. And we were hovering at like 4.7, and that you realize how fast it goes and what you actually are buying. I'll tell you, to answer your first part, like, you know, how do you become a first-time director, or how do you tackle it? First, you just accept the fact that you are going to go to a store that sells only stress, and they're just going to sell you a bunch of it even though you don't want it, and they're going to attach it to your back, and you can't get rid of it. that's part one. So that becomes your coat of stress. So you have your outfit. And then you just, you know, when we had a reset, when those 3 years were going to be up, we said, you know what, we're going to just direct it ourselves with our friend Kevin Walsh, who was our producing partner and friend. He just said, let's just attach ourselves and let's just do this. You're the guys who know this movie the best. And we just went as grassroots as we could, you know, contacting actors respectfully through their representatives, but also trying to do a personal approach with a letter or something to try to coerce them to trust us as first-time directors and with the material. But you know, we knew right away, and it was a wonderfully complicated, stressful, exciting, and daunting experience. You know, all the great positives and negatives sort of in the same neighborhood of each other.
And it's one thing to direct a film on your own. It's another thing to have a co-director. It's one thing to write a movie on your own. It's another thing to have a co-writer. You have the same guy co-directing, co-writing here, but you are two individuals. You can't agree on everything. What's your process? How do you work together?
Well, then I would go back to our education, which is improv, and the reason that I love it so much. It really is at its core about communication and being able to check your ego at the side and realize this story is not about me. It's about my partner, and I'm going to put them on a pedestal and make their story stronger. And so for this, Nat and I were friends before we began this whole thing. So I think we always remind ourselves that that's paramount to whatever might come our way. And I think that because we came from improv, where it is working together, we tried to let that translate just the way we write together. We translate that to directors. So we always tried to act as a consensus. So we would, you know, between takes or whatever, you know, come to some kind of consensus that we agreed on. And then one of us would communicate that to crew or actors, you know, taking turns so that we weren't inundating everyone with our two wonderfully nasally voices. And those times we disagreed, then we accepted the fact that if someone felt, one of us felt very adamant about to do another take, to an alt, that we tried to allow ourselves to give them that, because you get in the edit room and you have no idea. You know, in other words, you might have needed it, or maybe you didn't need it, but you want to have it. So, you know, did we argue? Of course. And it usually was because of things we couldn't control, rain, time, things that made us both frustrated, and then that puts you on edge. But at the end of the day, that's not about you. That's just about circumstances. So those are easy things to get around.
You also told Jay Leno when you were on The Tonight Show this week that originally when this movie was going to be done with a different director who you've already mentioned, that you had to audition the two of you had to audition for the two small parts that you ended up having in this movie, the two parts that you wanted to be in this movie. And of course, now you've ended up as directors. So and the guy who was going to direct it didn't really like your audition very much.
Well,
so is the character that we're seeing you play in your movie what you brought to the audition, or did you take his advice?
No. This is props to Sean Levy, because he was. And I should say in his defense, you know, he wasn't as familiar with us as actors. And the character you see of Roddy, which is the character that Nat plays, is very much what was on the page. The initial idea behind Lewis was a character that I had done, not that incarnation, but a different incarnation of him, was a slightly heightened character that I had done at Groundlings. And in his defense, you know, my choice to try to perform that way was probably not the way to go. I will say that I totally embraced Lewis's low energy, you know, because I knew that it was different from Sam Rockwell's energy. And I love the idea, both Nat and I, of a curmudgeon amid this world that's supposedly in Oz. Mm-hmm. And this character who, against all odds, tries to put up this, you know, idea that he doesn't need this place, which is obviously fighting him, you know, for what probably isn't at the underbelly a love for this place. So I knew that part of it, you know, and maybe it wasn't the best audition in the world. So I know when I walk
seconds.
I can wait.
Okay. I was going to say that you were talking about this curmudgeon, and you're kind of like the gatekeeper in the original Oz.
We'll have more with Jim Rash in just a moment. His film, The Way, Way Back, is being released on DVD on Tuesday.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fuel Pizza, celebrating 15 years serving the Carolinas and offering fresh ingredients and healthy options. Delivery and online ordering available. Details at fuelpizza.com. And Machine Theater, presenting a guide for the newly dead, a dizzy look at the final frontier. Equal parts Sam Beckett and Bugs Bunny. October 24th through November 2nd at Spirit Square. Tickets at carolinatix.org. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, a panel of journalists will join Diane for analysis of this week's top national news stories, including the deal to reopen the government and stave off a Treasury default, Obamacare rollout glitches, and Newark Mayor Cory Booker's special election victory in the Senate. The National Hour at 10 and international news at 11 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show and the News Roundup here on 90.7 WFAE.
I love New York. Virginia is for lovers. Made in Alabama? I guess that's got a ring to it.
It captures the pride that we have, the competitive nature that Alabamians have. We love to win whatever we do.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Alabama's rebranding campaign, y'all. It's next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. Our guest today is Charlottean Jim Rash, who is now a Los Angelian, if that's how you say it. I guess a Hollywoodian, because yeah. he's on NBC's Community, and he just directed The Way, Way Back, which he also wrote with Nat Faxon. You were talking about your character in that movie, which and how you determined how to play him.
Well, you know, I have the opportunity here because we took a break to bail on what I was going to say, but I'm going to own it and say, because what I was getting ready to say is just say, like, look, I have, you know, we all have a bevy of times that we came into an audition room and we just, you know, for lack of a better expression, crapped the floor, or I don't know if that's allowed.
That's okay. We'll bleep it.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
Actually, we won't. We'll leave it in.
That didn't seem that dirty, you know. No, but we stunk it up. Let's say mm-hmm. put it that way. And we learn from those moments. And in that moment, I probably went in there and thought, well, you know, I got this because we wrote it. And then I realized, oh, okay. Well, you know, maybe I didn't need to work on this more.
Is it hard to get a film like this produced? I mean, Hollywood has a tendency to want to do these big blockbuster superhero special effects movies. And most of those, this summer at least, have been bombs at the box office. And here you come along with this really wonderful, very small film that is a slice of life and a coming-of-age movie that doesn't go too far in any direction. And it's, at least the Sunday afternoon that I saw this, the auditorium was packed. So, you've gotten terrific reviews from the LA Times, the Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine. Mm-hmm. I think 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. This is all good news.
Yeah, I think we knew we were going up against heavy hitters. You know, for Fox Searchlight to decide to put this into sort of the foray of summer. You know, you're definitely banking on counter programming to various movies. But I just feel like at the end of the day, the movies I love and hopefully people connect with are about character and story. And those can easily exist in big. You know, those can exist in any form, really. Like a really good action or alien adventure can still have tremendous amounts of story and heart and character. But, you know, sometimes it is just popcorn and fun. But I think that we react to human stories. I think we're always looking for a palate cleanser, you know, among other things. And I think movies often... The good news is there's always, hopefully, a library of different styles and taste for movies. But right now, it's difficult. You can either make a really small movie in Hollywood, or you make a gigantic movie. And I think the movies that are getting lost sometimes are the ones that fall in the middle. The movies that we probably look back on and go like, where broadcast news budget probably hovered at, and I don't know this for a fact by any means, but I take to heart what Alexander Payne said, who we obviously worked on The Descendants with, and Alexander Payne often will say, I didn't set out to make art house films. I thought I was making movies that I grew up on in the 70s, which would be bigger movies. So you think about back then, the movies that he's probably making were big budget movies, mm-hmm. you know, and they always have star power. They always have those things, but that's where stars and everyone are working for much less to produce a story they just love.
But you think that's why TV right now is so good? When you look at HBO and Showtime and FX and AMC and a couple of the other cable channels that are doing these really good shows. Is that why? Because these are the kinds of things that might have been two-hour movies but now have become series because no one will make the movies.
In a way, I don't, you know, I will say, like, you know, TV is having a very sort of golden age, particularly in the drama category, and more comedies are coming to this table as well, where they are embracing complicated, really, you know, question some characters that question, you could question their morals. You know, we have movies about serial killers, you know, we have TV shows and series about that, a series about, you know, like Breaking Bad, an English teacher, you know, a science teacher cooking meth, you know, to survive and pay for his treatments. They're complicated and they're, again, great storytelling. So yeah. I feel like TV is sort of latched onto this whole embracing of a whole, you know, new way of looking at things.
We cannot talk to Jim Rash about TV without talking about Community and the flamboyant character that you created, Craig Pelton, the dean of Greendale Community College.
Mm-hmm. Guys, I need to apologize for my behavior today. When I switched bodies with Jeffrey,
nope.
I thought I knew what it would be like to have Jeffrey inside of me.
That did not happen.
But as it turns out, having Jeffrey inside of me,
nope, again,
only brought out the worst in me. Which is to say, having Jeffrey inside of me...
No one was inside of anyone.
...was wrong to have Jeffrey inside of me.
Shut up!
So I'm sorry.
I'm surprised that got on commercial television.
Yeah,
despite,
we did it.
Yeah, despite that scene between you and Joel McHale, who plays Jeff Winger, who's a womanizer and a narcissist, your character is supposed to be sexually ambiguous. Really? How do you see him?
Well, you know, I do think, I mean, he was probably, you know, as the growth of the series, you know, and Dan Harmon from the very beginning, who created Community and all these wonderful characters for which we're all indebted to him for, you know, Dean Pelton certainly in the first season had an awakening, but it was via a obsession with Dalmatians, which was sort of this weird obsession that seemed oddly sensual and sexual. And then there was even a moment where locomotives became some kind of weird connection, because I think Dan always wanted it to be vague. And then Jeff Winger, played by Joel McHale, comes into his life, and Jeff becomes this person that the dean sort of idolizes, both as a person and probably, you know, it's a juggle between wants to be him or wants to be with him. Mm-hmm. But I think that I really do think the dean of the core, now granted he leans heavily on Jeff for this fascination and obviously is overt about it, but I do think that he is just a person who can easily sway all types of ways and a complicated man. But I think at his core is just a guy who loves this job and loves this school unconditionally and loves the people that inhabit this world. So I think he's I love that about him. I love that he makes really bad mistakes, but it's all from heart, you know, which is you know, admirable.
And do you love the fact that they're constantly putting you in a series of outrageous costumes?
Yes.
Have you ever said no to one?
No. I've embraced every one of them. You know, the rules of improv is yes and. So whenever I see it, I'm like, yes, you know, to always be in agreement. That started obviously a little bit in the first season, mm-hmm. and then you know it sort of built from there, because really it was because this school, he found a place that allowed him to sort of dip into this world. He used to make excuses and say that they were his sisters, and now he sort of embraces that he has literally a closet full of them.
Costume, yeah.
So I feel like whatever that is that's tapped into that, it's so much fun, and I'm like a human doll. I don't care, and you know I've been in everything from full costume to down to horrible flesh sort of underwear so that I look like I was naked. So at that point, you've sort of set your parameters And so you've already know that there's nowhere else to go. So you are going to fill the middle
This kind of shtick, I guess, has its roots in vaudeville, probably before vaudeville, but certainly Milton Berle on television years ago. And it's surprising to me that that kind of stuff is still funny. But it is. It's still funny. Why?
I don't know. That's a good question, because I can only speak in the context of what we're using it with Adeem, which obviously most of the costumes are for him to make an announcement that mm-hmm. does not need a costume to make the announcement to his students about what's coming up. And, you know, obviously a lot of them have been dresses or female, but there are the male ones that are snuck in there, you know, every now and then. I don't know. I think it is. There's something in us that loves absurdity, you know, and almost are connect with people who are allowed to go, oh, you know, because I think we all enjoy Halloween. We all enjoy dressing up, and something happens to us when we dress mm-hmm. up. We yes. completely become a different person. So I think people always have a fondness for the power of the confidence that a costume can give them, or to hide in one, you know. And so I think that's probably, we just love people who get to do it and not have and have to apologize.
Because we knew we'd have to record this conversation and not do it live, we gave an opportunity to our listeners to send us questions or comments on Facebook or email. And let me share a few of these with you. Heather on Facebook wrote, "My friends and I suspect that all Jim Rash does is work out and write."
Oh, no.
but you do have a flat stomach. Both with spectacular results. Kidding aside, he's a talented guy, and I always look forward to his new projects. When you see Jim's name appear on screen, you know whatever you're watching just got a little better.
Oh, that's nice. Very sweet. But the truth is, I type with one hand and lift barbells with the other at the same time. David, and I put my laptop on my stomach and do crunches.
Well, there you go.
As I type, which you can believe it or not.
Watch for the exercise videos.
Yeah. Oh my God. Please don't let that get shot or made, and please allow me never to make that choice.
David on Twitter: will Community make it to 6 seasons and a movie?
You know, Dan certainly would love that to happen. You know, Dan Harmon wasn't with us in the 4th season, but he's now back wonderfully mm-hmm. for the 5th season. And I think in his mind, he would love to, you know, that was proclaimed, and it's sort of like a goal, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great goal, you know, to consider. So we'll do our best, you know.
Kelly on Facebook says, "Charlotte Latin folks are proud Jim is an alum." April on Facebook: will you be doing any sketch comedy on or off stage soon? And what about a tour?
Wow, tour. I don't I do still, even though I sort of resigned from the main company, I still teach and direct and love to perform improv there. At the Groundlings, mm-hmm. sorry. And we often do, you know, best of shows every now and then, whether for charity or just for our own enjoyment. So nothing set in stone that I'm going to do, but, you know, I certainly love that aspect.
You know, a lot of your Saturday night, a lot of your Groundling colleagues down through the years have appeared on Saturday Night Live. You auditioned, I'm told, for Saturday Night Live, and they turned you down. Are they kicking themselves now?
I doubt it. Because I wouldn't, again, I said humbly that you walk into a room and you give an audition and sometimes you stink up the room and it wasn't meant to be. And mm-hmm. and I'd love to say that I went in there and nailed it and they didn't get it. But the truth is, what happened, what was wonderful was, like, at the time that I got called for Saturday Night Live, I was actually working as the interim theater manager at the Groundlings because we had let go someone, and I was sort of reliable in some people's minds, which was probably insane. And I took over for like 3 months mm-hmm. while our board and us searched for a new candidate. And I was working in the back office, and I get a phone call from Saturday Night Live looking for, of all people, my writing partner, Nat Faxon. And so they're like, "Yes, hi, this is so-and-so from Saturday Night Live." And we were trying to get in touch with Nat Faxon. So I'm super excited because he's obviously my friend. And I'm like, absolutely, you know, I'm trying to be professional. And so I give him the information. And then, of course, I call him immediately, you know, to say, "They're going to call you about, you're going to be on Saturday Night Live." Probably got call waiting. And I had to hang up as they called him. And so I was like, "Oh, that's great." And then a call comes in a few minutes later, same person going, "Oh, hi, this is so-and-so from Saturday Night Live. We also wanted to find Jim Rash." And, of course, I couldn't help but say, oh, you're actually speaking to him now on the phone. I'm just being professional. And she goes, oh, you know, great. You know, we would love for you to come out and an audition for Saturday Night Live. And I, of course, then was over the moon. And they decided to do something different that year. I'm sorry, this might be a tad bit long story, but I'll get through it. But and so they decided
to do
You
got 2 minutes.
Oh, my God, I have to rush. We did do an improv – they had to do an improv audition where we went to UCB Theater in New York. And us, Nat, I, and literally it was like all guys were going to do what's called a Herald, which is a long-form structure of improv. I'm not – we weren't super familiar. I mean, we were familiar with it, but that's not part of our studying. So anyway, it was just one of those things where they had an audience. We were only going to improvise. And that's hard because it's a 20-minute time frame to try to get yourself heard and understood and funny and good in that moment. And it just was a really tough Herald where we all were trying our best to get our bits in and it wasn't connecting. Anyway, long story short, Jack McBrayer was in our audition, who off. So he went on to 30 Rock, and Fred Armisen opened for us doing a bit, and he made it. So good came out of it because two wonderful guys went on to great things.
I got 90 seconds left, and I know that you're about to embark on another TV project. You're hosting a new show called The Writer's Room for the Sundance Channel. I watched the first episode online today. You're talking about Breaking Bad with the writers and the star of Breaking Bad. How did this come about? You're really good at this, by the way.
Thank you so much. I love this show, and it starts, Monday at 10 p.m., July 29th. It'll be Mondays at 10. We did 6 episodes. Basically, Sundance approached me and wondered if I would be interested in hosting this show that was really just me sitting down with the writing staffs of popular shows. And Breaking Bad's the first one I sat down with. And it really is about the process of writing, which I love, and the process of staff writing, which is a whole nother beast. So it really is about the inner workings. And we did Breaking Bad. I met with Parks and Rec. I met with Game of Thrones. I met with Dexter. Just wonderful, wonderful shows. And I'm really proud of the show because I feel like there are writers everywhere. So I think writers will appreciate it and then fans of the show will appreciate it.
And I've got literally 20 seconds. Have you learned anything in the process of doing that show about writing that you didn't know?
No. Well, I will say this. I learned one of my favorite tricks of the trade. This is from a writer, not particularly on the show, but just when I was talking to the show. She said, when you get writer's block, when you are beating your head against the wall, go run an errand. And that is the idea of going to do the dry cleaner, go to the bank, and allow your brain to relax, and you will think of an idea, and I did.
That's Jim Rash from NBC's Community, recorded back in July. His movie, The Way, Way Back, is out on DVD on Tuesday.